From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll hear from the director of Milwaukee Recreation, who's retiring in the new year. We'll speak with an author who wrote about his experience seeing a total solar eclipse with his son.
I thought I knew what I was going to experience, but the moment it was a total eclipse and we took off our eclipse glasses, everyone was hooting and everyone was cheering. It was just a really fascinating experience.
Plus, from Midwest classics to savory dishes, we'll explore some of the best desserts Milwaukee has to offer.
I just think the definition of desserts can be changed and it can evolve, and it is evolving.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's top stories. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Milwaukee Recreation's director Lynn Greb announced this fall that she will retire from the department at the end of January. She began her career with Milwaukee Rec in 1989 and worked her way to become director of the department in 2015. Lake Effect's Exgrit Nunez speaks with Greb about the work she's accomplished throughout her career and what's next for Milwaukee Recreation.
Why did you decide this was the right time for you to retire?
Ooh, good question. I'll let you know that answer in a few years if it was the right time, but I guess I say that we were working on a pretty big project that came from the COVID funding that Milwaukee Public Schools received. And one of the areas that we directed a portion of that funding was to extracurricular activities. And I was assigned to be the project lead on that. And I knew it was a 3-year project because that was the term of the spending. So I thought, you know, maybe when that project is done, that might be a good stopping point because the next thing is always going to come along. So there really what is never that true break. But I feel like there's been some major things we've accomplished as a department, and maybe this hopefully was the right time to make that exit.
Absolutely. And so I'm sure you're also thinking about what will the next chapter for you be?
It's crazy. I'm thinking about it because I was thinking, okay, the first 12 years you're going to school, then you're going to college. So you have everything's kind of figured out for me anyhow it was. And then I got my job and then I've been in that for 36 years. So I actually don't know what it feels like to be unscheduled for an extended period of time. So I think it's going to be really interesting to figure that out. Like, I feel like the first work day of my retirement, I might just be like lost, not knowing what to do. But when people retire, I say enjoy being a full-time recreator, because like for me, that would be totally my goal. I've been a full-time recreation employee for many years, and now I'm looking forward to being that other kind of full-time recreator and experiencing a lot of things that I've seen other people enjoy, and now a chance to see it from the other side.
Right. And you began your career with Milwaukee Recreation nearly 36 years ago. How did you first get interested and involved in public recreation?
I remember I was at the University of Whitewater and I took a class on Introduction to Recreation, because at that point I was thinking I loved sports, I like to be active, so they didn't have a major in recreation, but they had physical education. So I thought, oh, I'll look into that area. So I took this Intro to Recreation class and I was like, oh my gosh, I could do this for a career. Like, you know, there are people that do this work full time. And the class just really intrigued me. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to shift directions here. And I ended up transferring to UWM Milwaukee, which at that time had a major in recreation, and took it from there. And it was just a great start because I enjoyed the classes, the subject matter. And yeah, then I went from there.
That's amazing. I'm wondering too, like, what are the different positions you've held throughout your career?
Well, the first full-time job I had was as an activity specialist. And my job was to go around to the various schools in Milwaukee Public Schools and teach leisure education units to the special ed classes. So we'd spend like 6 weeks in a class, and I would teach them table games, and we'd do an art project 1 week, and then we'd do a cooking project, teaching them different ways to enjoy their free time and find things that interest them. And then I moved into more of the community rec side. I started in therapeutic recreation. That was actually my undergraduate degree. And the big project I was assigned at that time was the recreation guide.
Whoa.
Which many people that if you live in the city of Milwaukee, you get a copy 4 times a year. And so a lot of our corrections were by hand with photocopies of multiple copies. So it was a very interesting process, but I got to know a lot about what we offered as a department. I got to know all my colleagues because we all had to work together on the copy. So I did that for many years. I also had dabbled in a number of special projects over time. My job kind of evolved from that. A cool thing I got to do was write a grant to get funding to start our mobile recreation van that travels to various shelters and community activities. From that position, I moved into the after-school realm, and I was overseeing all of our community learning centers and childcare camps and working with a team of people on that program. I did that for a number of years. From there, then I got hired as the manager of operations, which got me into more of the budgeting, the facility areas of our operation, the technology. I still worked with the marketing area. So I did that for a number of years. And then in 2015, my former boss, Molly Barrett, retired as the director. And that's when I was able to step into that role in 2015.
So you really know the ins and outs of Milwaukee Recreation and worked your way up.
I did. And I think that, you know, we have such a long history in the city of Milwaukee. Our department really started in 1911, and there's such a rich tradition to our operation. I've always enjoyed working for a large department serving the city of Milwaukee. There's various amounts of need for recreation services throughout our community. So having to be able to be in a position to impact that has always kept me motivated, because I see the value of what our programs can do. And I know there's a lot of people that can benefit from that. It's just been a joy to be involved.
Absolutely. So in the past decade that you've been the director of Milwaukee Recreation, you've led several projects, including the department's Dream Build Play initiative. Can you tell me about this project and what you envisioned for it when you first started as the director?
Yes. So we maintain 52 play fields throughout the city of Milwaukee, and they're smaller type parks where they have some recreational amenities and some green space. And for many years, we maintain those play spaces and we program them. That was really our responsibility. But over time, there wasn't the investment in making sure those facilities were meeting the needs of the neighborhood. And of course, time, weather, use wore a lot of these play fields down. And I was just seeing this opportunity that we could do something more than just program these sites and maintain them. And I think what the thing we're most proud of with that particular project is that the basis of it all was around equity. And when we started looking at which playfield do we do first, we have 52, and honestly, over 60% were rated at like fair to poor condition. Mm. So the odds of finding one to do, it was very great because there were so many that needed help. But I heard the former director in Minneapolis Parks and Recreation, I saw something they had done, and they created this matrix that looked at a number of characteristics of each neighborhood. And then by looking at those characteristics and doing some analyses, they came up with a rating system. And then they rank ordered all of their parks according to this, you know, poverty levels around the park or crime rates or number of children under 18. And so we took that concept and applied it here in Milwaukee. And by doing that, we came up with really our priorities for where we were going to invest initially where the need was the greatest, not just on the condition of the site, but the need of the neighborhood. And so I think 10 or so we've done now, if you know, you look at which locations they are, there's no arguing for this is where the investment was needed the most. And that's kind of how we're approaching these projects. So we have a long ways to go yet, but the ones that have been completed, I think, have really transformed neighborhoods.
So as you reflect on your 36 years within the department, nearly 10 as the director, is there anything you wish you could have accomplished during your time?
I hate to say no, like I've done it all and, you know, now it's time to close the door. But I can't help but think how fortunate I have been. I mean, I've always had a job I've enjoyed. I've enjoyed the people. Like, not everybody can say that. And I just am filled with gratitude that I landed in a job at Milwaukee Rec and I never looked at another job for my entire career. There was never another job. So when you ask me that question, nothing specific comes to mind like, ooh, if I only had, you know, one more year, I would do this. Because there's always going to be that next thing. So that's what made leaving hard because, you know, we're building this community center now. So do I stay until the community center is open? But then I know there'll be the next thing because that's just how we are as a department. Like, we're never settling for status quo or, well, that's good enough. Now we can just kind of sit back and, you know, change the date each year. It's always like, what is that next thing? What's that next trend? How can we? And so there never was probably going to be a time that things would just stop and then you'd know that's time to go. But I can't help but say how grateful I am for the opportunity to have done all the jobs I did and particularly to serve as the director because I always told people I had the best job in the district, and I believe that. It just, I love watching people enjoy their free time doing things that make them happy, and to say, you know, we had a part of that, and to be in a position to help make some decisions that can make things better for people. Couldn't have asked for a better career.
Absolutely. Yeah. I do want to briefly bring up the Department of Athletics and Academics, which is a department you oversee. Milwaukee's Common Council released a statement of no confidence in NPS Athletics Commissioner Bobby Kelsey after the department failed to file paperwork that resulted in the two Milwaukee schools forfeiting their football season. What's your response to this?
Well, my response is that last Friday, myself and one of the coaches from one of the teams had the opportunity to present an appeal to the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association Board of Control, really presenting our case that we know our athletes had missed postseason play this year because of the failure to get that paperwork submitted. But in lieu of going with 2 years, which is generally the sanction for that non-reporting error, we were able to get the Board of Control to vote in favor of reducing our suspension from the postseason down to 1 year. So what initially was a very unfortunate situation, and certainly feel very sorry to our student athletes that this impacted, you know, by making this appeal, we could salvage the second year of what would have been a 2 year postseason ban. So in that regard, I feel like that was a positive outcome for us, and fortunate to the Board of Control for listening to our appeal and, you know, supporting that. So we're just working hard to put procedures in place and make checks and balances so that this kind of oversight isn't something we have to deal with in the future.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for your response.
Yep.
So before, you know, we start wrapping up the end of our conversation, I want to ask, like, how do you envision the future of Milwaukee Recreation?
I envision it probably like maybe other people did 36 years ago, that, you know, in 36 years, somebody else may be sitting in this chair talking about all the amazing things that the department has accomplished. And being a part of that. And again, I feel like when you have your base is so solid, like the recreation department is and has been, I don't have any concerns that the great work is going to be continued. There's so many wonderful staff that we have that really do all the work day in and day out, and all the part-time staff we have. We have, you know, well over 1,000 individuals that we hire as instructors, officials, timers, scorekeepers, building staff, event staff. Like, there's so many people I've crossed paths with that I just can't say enough about, like, the fact that people would dedicate their time above and beyond many of them having full-time jobs to come and work for the recreation department so that we can do everything that we do. And so with that unit of people, I have no doubt that the wonderful work will continue. There's enough people that understand the history, and they will pass that on. And it will just keep evolving, and they'll be celebrating their 200th anniversary down the road and looking back at 2024 and what was happening then. And so, yes, I'm very grateful and optimistic that everything is going to be in good hands. And hopefully I'll be maybe a participant enjoying some of these classes I've always seen in the book and never had the chance to sign up for.
Wow. Yeah. Well, Lynn, thank you so much for speaking with me today and reflecting on your career with Milwaukee Recreation with me.
Thank you. It's fun talking about it. So I think that reflects the fun I've had doing the work. So thank you very much.
Lynn Greb is the Milwaukee Recreation's outgoing director, and she spoke with LakeFX Ex-Grid Nunez. At the end of January, Greb will retire as Milwaukee Recreation's 10th director in the department's 114-year history. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. From cherry strudel to rosewater tres leches cake, in about 10 minutes we'll be exploring what Milwaukee's dessert scene has to offer. But first, we'll speak with an author who shared his experience seeing a total solar eclipse with his son by writing a children's book. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. During a total solar eclipse, the moon passes between the sun and Earth, blocking the bright face of the sun and revealing our star's pearly white atmosphere. To see this, you've got to head to what's called the path of totality. That's the path the moon's shadow takes across the Earth. If you're in the right place at the right time, for a brief moment, day becomes night. There was a total solar eclipse visible in the U.S. this past spring and back in 2017. That's when Andy Rash drove to Illinois to see it with his young son. He shares that story in a children's book called Eclipse. Rash is a children's book author and illustrator and teaches at MIAD. He speaks with WUWM's Lena Tran.
Tell me about this book and where it began for you.
I went with my son to see the total eclipse in 2017 when he was just 7 years old, and it was just the two of us on this trip. And we were so amazed by the just the whole experience of it that it never really left me, and so I wrote a picture book, and it stars me and my son and just tells the story of viewing an eclipse, hoping that people will go out and try to see the eclipse that's coming up, especially the one in April.
As an author and an artist, you're able to convey to people like how great eclipses are and, you know, why they should go out of their way to see them. How do you describe, you know, what an eclipse is or what that experience was like?
Well, first of all, the one thing that made a huge difference was going to the path of totality. It makes a lot of difference. And we just looked on a website to tell us where to go. I tried my best through my illustrations to try to convey what an it's a really fascinating, unusual experience. It looks very, very strange and extremely beautiful. I just tried my best with gouache and digital to recreate the experience.
And something that's fun about this book is that you wrote it from your son's perspective. What was that like?
He actually wrote a project for school about this trip too, and that really inspired me. I thought the perspective of the son would be the more engaging for kids. And the anticipation that goes throughout the book is, it's intended to kind of mirror the, as the sun approaches the moon, passes behind it, and then continues on.
Yeah, I absolutely got that. I love that it's framed around this countdown. I'm sure that's really fun for kids, but it's like 2 months I've been planning, you know, a week we're packing, a day left that me and my dad are driving down. And it really captures the sense of anticipation that's so unique with eclipses, which is that we know exactly when and where it's going to happen down to the second. But once it does, it's just like you totally lose yourself in all of these strange emotions that you didn't really know that you could feel about the sun.
It was really surprising. I mean, I thought I knew what I was going to experience, but the moment it was a total eclipse and we took off our eclipse glasses, everyone was hooting and, you know, and everyone was cheering and crickets were chirping. It was just a really fascinating experience.
Do you remember what your son's reaction was at that time and what it was like to share with him?
I do, especially because I took a video, you know, and you can't see anything because it's phone video, but I could hear what he was saying, and he was really, really excited, and it was an extremely, you know, it was a really breathtaking experience.
Andy actually dug out that video that he took in 2017 during totality. You can hear the excitement.
Oh! Oh, look without your glasses, buddy. Whoa! Wow.
Wow.
Wow. Pretty good.
Take a bunch of pictures.
Well, we're super lucky in the U.S. that we have another eclipse coming up, another total solar eclipse coming up in April. So for any coronaphiles or anyone that is like converted by this conversation is like, wow, I really want to see this, there's another opportunity. But what I love about the end of your book is that you have your son, he's like already looking forward to the next one. And at the time, it must have sounded so far away. That's 7 years ago. But I love how you really capture the passage of time. There's this really lovely illustration of you two together at presumably the next eclipse, and he's taller than you, there's more gray in your hair. Yeah, reflect on the time that's passed, and what do you guys have planned for the eclipse next year?
You know, when I drew that image, the intention was that it was going to be an eclipse much further in the distance, but since my son is 13, he is nearly as tall as me now, and I was looking at that last illustration, and it's just like, oh no, that's already happened. We know that we are going to be going to see it on the path of totality, and going to bring the rest of my family this time as well, because it's just not to be missed. Then there's the annular eclipse that's going to be happening on October 14th. I've been invited to the Air and Space Museum in D.C., and I'm going to be presenting the book there. So that's where I'll be for that one.
It's such a cool way to mark the passage of time on our planet. Just like these crazy intersections of Earth and the sun and the moon.
It's an enormous clock. It's really amazing. And I have maps in the front of the back of the book that show where the paths will be far into the future. So we know where eclipses will be, like in the distant future already.
Okay, so imagine that you have a friend who is looking at this map for next year's eclipse and is like, oh, it seems like kind of a long drive and there'll be probably a lot of traffic. What would you say to your friend to be like, no, you should totally take your kid and go. It's really worth it.
I would say they're right. It's going to be a lot of traffic. Getting back took forever. And there's actually a page devoted to traffic in the book. But I think it's absolutely worth it. It was just a world-shaking experience for us, and we still talk about it all the time, even outside, you know, the context of publishing this book.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Andy Rash is a children's book author whose newest book is called Eclipse. He spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran last year. What's your favorite place to get custard? It's a question that can unite or divide people. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn if there's a way to really decide what the best custard is. But first, if you're looking for more than a cup or cone of custard, we'll tell you about some places to try dessert in Milwaukee. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Holidays and desserts go hand in hand. But if you have a sweet tooth like me, desserts are always something to be enjoyed and explored year-round. In this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine, writer Ann Christensen wrote all about local desserts for her article, How Sweet It Is. She explores everything from classic Midwestern comfort treats to creative made-to-order restaurant experiences, so there's something for everyone to crave. To share more about how Milwaukee's dessert scene is expanding and some of the standout makers and bakers behind it, Christensen joins me now. And welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thanks, it's good to be here.
So I have a feeling we all know the basics of why desserts are so satisfying, right? There's that initial and immediate satisfaction when you bite into something tasty. But what makes a dessert stand out to you?
Wow, it's almost like it's hard to not say it's a subjective thing because it kind of is. But first of all, yes, it has to like be wonderfully flavorful and have this texture that is just fantastic. But it also, in my opinion, needs to conjure up something like a memory, anything really. I feel like desserts are so connected to memory, more so maybe than other foods. A dessert, though, it could be beautiful and it could taste good, but I might be like, I don't know, if it just doesn't resonate, you know? I don't know. I think it's kind of fascinating to think about and talk about.
Well, and this piece kind of got you on the hunt for any desserts that resonated with you to feature in this. And there's a nice and, I'll admit, a surprising range of places to go to with the scale of desserts. But I want to start us off with perhaps a little more of a classic approach, like what I view as typical Midwestern comfort desserts. And that's starting with treats at Midwest Sad. There's a lot of stuff on their menu and it changes a lot. But what stood out to you about Midwest Sad and what they offer?
Well, first of all, I kind of love that the owner, Sam Sandrin, named it Midwest Sad because, it taps into, Midwestern comfort, but also the idea of seasonal affective disorder and how maybe eating desserts are kind of uplifting, you know, they're kind of the antidote to that. So I kind of love that. But I also just, I really love the stuff that she does there. You know, she's got, I don't know, she's got everything from chocolate chip cookies, really thick ones, thick, fluffy, but chewy, to banana pudding with vanilla wafers. You look at it and you taste it and you're like, oh, this isn't about being a highfalutin pastry chef. This is just a really delicious, satisfying dessert. And I feel like her baked goods are very much like that. Now, the other thing is she is located in kind of an interesting location as well. The lower level of this building on Jefferson Street, kind of across from Taylor's, and there's like a food court, but it isn't like a busy food court down there. I mean, there's Shah G's, which is an Indian restaurant, and she's down there as well. And she just has a window. And you go up there and she's got a lot of her baked goods just kind of like stacked up on shelves in the window area so you can see them. And I don't know, it's just, and she comes to, you know, comes to the register and she rings up your order and checks you out. And, you know, you can just tell that she's really passionate about what she does too. And that's the other thing about the story that I really, really liked was to talk to different pastry chefs in town about, what it's like to be a pastry chef and what drew them to it and what keeps them inspired.
Did you find any commonalities between them? Because there's such a range of places and obviously a range of dishes and what they specialize in or favor. But yeah, is there a common thing for pastry chefs and people who make desserts?
Yeah, I don't think that I necessarily found one. I was really intrigued by, I talked to the pastry chef from Loopy and Iris. She's a classically trained pastry chef, and her desserts are incredibly elevated and beautiful and delicious. And then I talked to the pastry chefs, the two individuals who do pastries at Estarev, and both of them come from savory backgrounds.
Right, I did
So,
want to talk about that. Like, their whole approach to dessert is going savory, which at
yeah.
first glance, you're like, oh, this seems counterintuitive.
Right. But honestly, I think that's something we're going to see more of. These desserts that are, they come from this idea of, oh, it's not going to be achingly sweet, but you want something that scratches that itch, though, too, for something sweet.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of a debate. I don't know if we can solve today, but yeah, do desserts need to be sweet? Is that the definition of a dessert?
Yes. And you know what? I maybe would have said before I did this story, yeah, they need to be sweet, but I don't know. I don't know that I believe that. And I don't get into this type of dessert, but I've been to plenty of French restaurants where instead of a sweet dessert, you might have cheese and different things to go with cheese. So, and I think that can make a wonderful dessert too. I don't really get into that here, but I just think the definition of desserts can be changed and it can evolve, and it is evolving.
When it comes to desserts, obviously you go many places, restaurants, etc. There's a dessert menu. It's a common thing, but spaces dedicated to desserts outside of bakeries is kind of rare, and that's why the Third Ward Sweetly Baked stood out to me. So can you share a bit more about Sweetly Baked and what makes it unique for Milwaukee's food scene?
Yeah, that bakery actually started during pandemic, and the owner was doing kind of more pickup, and her whole niche was baked goods that have CBD in them. And I don't get into desserts like that in the story. I think that's something a little bit different, and if you're looking for that, that's great. But over the course of time, she has branched out to offer baked goods that also are just non-CBD infused. Okay. So she's got like macarons and cookies and just little pettifora type things. And she opened like a brick and mortar in the old Press Waffles in the Third Ward. And she decided to open late on weekend nights and have it be kind of like, oh, this is okay if you're going out for dinner, or maybe not even going out for dinner, but like you want a place to have a cocktail or a glass of wine or something and a dessert. That's a place you can go to, and that's what you get specifically. And I think it's a really fun idea. And I also love that what she does is she curates a lot of these beverages and desserts so that they really work together. So she can make recommendations, based on the flavor profiles or the richness of a dessert, how well it might go with a particular wine or cocktail or something. So I really love that idea.
You were also able to include some recipes for people to try at home, and there is a build-out for crème anglaise and poached pears. So why did you think these two are good standard recipes to put out there to introduce to people if they haven't tried it?
Well, first of all, I think they're really easy to make. And I think they can be used in different ways too. So you can like make them for guests. And they're super impressive. But they're also just really, really delicious. And I know that making desserts can be really intimidating. You know, you're like, oh my God, I don't want to just make chocolate chip cookies. That's all I can do. I just really like the idea of offering a couple of recipes that were not that were a little more elaborate and could kind of stretch someone's capabilities a little bit and be like, oh, I can do that. That's really easy. And it's also just something that I think you could do over and over again.
And if someone isn't quite ready to dive into baking any desserts for themselves, you do give a nice around the world spotlight for places in the Milwaukee area for a range of different desserts. You know, everything from Ascani purist to nostalgia seeker, chocoholic. Do any of these stand out to you in this moment that you want to give a shout out for listeners to go and seek out and try?
I have to give a shout out to Sanford. I have to mention it because I don't know that people are aware of how great the desserts are there, and they're all made to order, and they're amazing. And so when you go to Sanford and you order your dinner, and it's a prefix menu, you always, need to choose everything right away, and they need to know what you're going to have for dessert because they're going to make it for you. And to me, that is just spectacular. Somebody making a dessert for you right at that moment. So it's warm. If it's a tart of some kind, it's warm out of the oven. I mean, they don't make the ice cream to order. I'm sure they make the ice cream ahead of time, but still, I mean, their desserts are just incredible. And I don't think they get enough credit for their pastry chef, to be honest.
Well, we'll give them credit here today to start. Another thing you include, there's such a good range here, but I love your literal pie chart. And it's not the mathematical one people might be thinking about, but a chart of pies and rankings and where to get them. So, any pies in particular that stand out to you as a good starting point for people who are wanting to maybe expand the kinds of pies they're trying and tasting?
Ooh, well, it's hard to have a conversation about pies and not mention Honey Pie and Small Pie, which is their other business, because they specialize so intricately in pies and doing fruit pies, cream pies, specialty pies, and their pies are just fantastic. So when I was doing that, I specifically wanted to get a pie that I knew was like a top seller for them. That's why I went with the cherry pie with the crumble on top. I would say that was one of the best pies that we sampled. And that was a staff sampling of all those pies.
Oh, good. Yeah, I was wondering your methodology for your
Yeah,
chart.
well, it's hard to do that as one person, and our staff has some very strong viewpoints, and I was happy to have them part of that.
Well, whether people like pies, tarts, chocolate, fondue, sweet drinks, there's so much covered in this piece. So, Anne, I want to thank you so much for joining me today on Lake Effect to share more.
Thanks. It's been really fun.
Anne Christensen is a writer who covers dining for a Milwaukee magazine. She joined me to talk about local desserts, and you can find more treat recommendations and recipes in this month's issue.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM Sam Woods, and I love frozen custard. Truthfully, I love all frozen treats, and custard pie, and dairy generally. But this is not a story of my sometimes questionable dietary choices. This is a story of frozen custard culture in Milwaukee and three questions WUWM listener Sarah Brecky asked Bubbler Talk.
How many individual custard places does Milwaukee have? How many started in Milwaukee? And is there a current standing rating?
On the surface, the first two questions seem straightforward and the most delicious story assignment I've ever been on. And the short answer is custardmke.com, created by Noah Hatari, tracks custard locations with real-time updates on things like flavors of the day. The site's map includes 51 locations in the Milwaukee area. Of these, 33 are Culver's, which, despite being ubiquitous in Milwaukee today, originated in Sauk City. But it turns out that conducting an official custard census, much like the official once-a-decade population census, is anything but straightforward. Some custard stands close for the season. Others don't advertise, relying on word-of-mouth marketing, or invest more in advertising their burgers than their custard. And historically, this has always been the case. Bobby Tanzillo and Kathleen McCann co-authored Milwaukee Frozen Custard, a book covering the treat's local history. When researching the book, McCann said they relied just as much on ephemera and emailed tips as they did official records.
It was actually really hard to research and track because a lot of the stands didn't have heavy advertising or anything like you would expect today. You know, the way you find out about a custard stand might be someone would tell you or email you, or you'd see a matchbook somewhere that had the name and address of a custard stand.
Tanzillo adds that often custard stands did not need to advertise their location at all, relying instead on their proximity to social gatherings.
There were a lot of sort of neighborhood kind of stands, you know, that, like there was one on 72nd and North in Tosa that, you know, probably didn't need to advertise because they had so much local business after like Tosa East football games and things that they just didn't even need to advertise because everybody kind of knew what was in their neighborhood. And as she said before, there was just so much business.
But how did we get here? And how did custard become ingrained in Milwaukee culture? For that, we have to turn back the clock about a century. The year is 1919. The location, Coney Island, New York. According to Travel Wisconsin, it was here that two brothers added egg yolk to ice cream for a smoother texture. The brothers sold thousands of cones in their first weekend. McCann explains how, by the 1933 World's Fair in Chicago, custard had hit the Midwest and would begin taking root in Wisconsin.
It was a big hit, and that's how it probably came to Milwaukee, because that's when kind of the first stands appeared. Now, why it's continued is really hard to say, except that here people really perfected it.
By 1950, McCann said custard culture was here to stay in Milwaukee. Imagine a custard stand on nearly every corner, often here just for a season, or for a few years before disappearing, sometimes popping up elsewhere, and sometimes being replaced by another stand. Tanzillo said the ubiquity of custard stands is no accident. Certainly the popularity of the product helped drive business, but in addition, Milwaukee custard producers did not play by the established rules of American capitalism. Instead of jostling in a fight to emerge as the sole custard king, the business of custard was a story of cooperative economics.
If you look at a guy like Leon Schneider, who opened Leon's in 1942, he worked at Gillies, he helped Elsa Kopp open Kopp's, he helped open Trudy's, he helped open Kit's, you know, he was selling machines, and his son was selling machines to other custard stands, and they would, and actually still continue to offer advice to other custard stands when they have questions about the machines and how to perfect making custard, because Leon always said that he wanted everyone to make good custard, because if somebody tried custard somewhere else and didn't like it, they would just decide they didn't like custard, and that would be bad for his business and everyone's business. So there was always this kind of cooperation toward keeping the quality strong.
Tanzillo and McCann say that there are certainly fewer custard stands today than there were in mid-century Milwaukee. But the evidence of this cooperation lives on in the product available in today's stands. But back to Sarah's last question about a standard custard rating, which I guess begs the question, what is custard? First off, there are actually federal regulations about this. For example, the FDA mandates that in order to advertise as custard, the product has to be at least 1.4% egg yolks by weight and 10% butterfat. But Kurt Fogel, partner at Dairyland Old Fashioned Hamburgers and Frozen Custard, said this doesn't mean the feds are consistently testing his frozen treats.
I haven't had any FDA investigators come. I think we're a drop in a ocean of ice cream products out there. So I think we're a little bit too small for their radar. But in order to achieve the quality that we're after, we have to hit these numbers anyways.
As it turns out, Fogel and other custard makers treat custard as a science, hitting precise percentages of ingredients and storage temperatures to get a consistent taste. While the end product is a fun treat, you can't just make custard on vibes alone.
You might get lucky on vibes once, but no, I performed very poorly in math and science and in high school and college. And it turns out that most of my job is math and chemistry. And for that,
And if you ask Fogel about the science behind custard, he'll tell you all about it, from balancing sugars and stabilizers, ideal storage temperatures, how often the custard needs to churn, all of that. And he does say that there are technical items you can judge a custard by.
Flavor, texture, probably tied for importance. One thing that a lot of people know but maybe don't think about is the serving temperature of custard. It's a lot warmer than traditional ice cream.
And there have been attempts to judge custard in a standardized way. There is an annual custard contest at the state fair, and in their book, Tanzillo and McCann discuss the 1981, quote, Custard's Last Stand competition that attempted to settle this question. But they also note that competitions like these are not the best for judging custard, because real custard needs to continually churn, and transporting custard messes with its texture. It's just not the same if it doesn't come directly from a stand.
I'm not sure the consistency was probably at its best for any of them. I mean, it was probably, they were equally, you know, hampered by it. If you wanted to do multiple stands in one day, that would probably be your ideal taste test. But as far as getting it all together, you would have to transport it somehow. I just don't think it's a fair test.
But back to Kurt Fogel. Kurt, let's cut to the chase. What makes a good frozen custard?
Well, let me ask you a question first. Are you from Milwaukee?
Not originally, but I've lived here for about 7 years.
Okay. So a lot of people who are from the area grew up with one of these shops in their neighborhood or one that they went, that their parents took them to for their childhood. That's the number one thing you have to compete with in this business is nostalgia. Everybody's favorite custard place is the place they were raised on. So quality comes in second place, in my opinion, to that.
This throws a wrench in our mission to standardize a rating system for custard. As much as flavor matters, creaminess matters, and storage temperature matters, there's just a you had to be there element to custard. Sarah Brecky alluded to this as well, how her memories of community have been made where custard was involved, but not entirely the focus.
Well, funny enough, last year, when one of my friends came up to visit from Colorado, we went on a custard crusade. So every day we went to a different custard spot and tried their custard for like 5 days straight. So I definitely love my custard.
And I have to say, Milwaukee custard culture agrees. Sarah and I visited a frozen custard stand recently, with the goal being to hear from Milwaukee's custard fiends, the people for which custard is a year-round indulgence. People who venture out in sub-freezing temperatures in the evening December darkness for their custard fix. We wanted to hear from these loyal custard consumers about what mattered most between flavor, texture, and temperature to inform our rating system, but when Sarah took the mic and started asking people about custard, what we found confirmed Fogel's suspicions.
Right, so it's freezing cold and we're out here talking about custard, so everyone loves custard. Yes, best time to get it. Mm-hmm. So what is your like core memory with custard?
My core memory is, I think just coming here as a little kid and then going to other states and them their ice cream not being good.
Before childhood, for sure. It's something about it, the sweet taste of it. It just makes you feel like that little treat at the end of a meal. Or if you just want to go out during the summertime or even now for the wintertime, you know, you just want to have that, you know, family time. And it just brings back, I think it just brings the family together and it gives you that real like holiday feeling and just all year round, but mainly like.
Pero son unas memorias que están alrededor de la familia, con diversión, jugar con los chicos, hacer el muñeco de nieve.
Since I was a little kid, so I think as little as like 8 years old, my grandma brought here for my first time, and ever since I loved it. So I'm still coming. I'm 22 now, so you know, I obviously still love it. Oh yes, she would take me all the time when I was little, and she actually passed away not that long ago. So, you know, that's like a core memory with me, you know, is, you know, I remember she would always take me to go get some ice cream. I was like, let's go. So, you know, that sticks with me to this day.
Support for Bubbly Talk comes from Perlamo's Pizza and Educators Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
And Bubbler Talk wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Chuck Kornbach and Mayan Silver from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon, where we'll highlight some of the big cases coming in front of the state Supreme Court in the upcoming year, including abortion access and collective bargaining rights. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.